My 10 favorite books of 2017. Published December 28th, 2017. This is the first of what I plan to be an annual book roundup. The roundup will comprise of a list of every book I read that year, as well as my list of 10 favorites with summaries and comments. Note that these are not books released in 2017, but books that I read in 2017. The top 10 are judged based on impact they had on me when I read them, the quality of their writing and ideas, and they are loosely grouped based on the areas of my life that they informed and influenced. After that, I've provided a list of every book I read this year in order from in which I read them. After that is a list of every book I started reading at some point, but chose to stop, as well as a brief explanation of why I stopped. You could treat this last list as kind of a most disappointing books of 2017. But first, the numbers. This year I read 66 books. 35 were general nonfiction, 13 were biography or memoir, 11 were fiction, and 7 were philosophy. In total, I read 22,378 pages, averaging 61.3 pages per day and 339 pages per book. I also started and failed to finish 14 other books. Of the 66 books, 16 of them, or 24%, were written by women. That's not a great percentage, although I'm sad to say it's probably better than previous years, as I was actually trying to read more books by women this year. While I can definitely do better with this, unfortunately the genres that most interest me, philosophy, science, politics, fantasy, are all male-dominated, thus it's kind of an uphill battle. This gender thing is something readers point out to me every time I do a book's post, so I'm just getting in front of it now. Yes, I'm aware of it. Yes, I'm making an effort. No, it's probably not going to stop being a thing anytime soon, unfortunately. Finally, for those who care, and to preempt another 50 emails asking me about it, here are my reading habits. 30 to 60 minutes first thing in the morning, 30 to 60 minutes before bed at night, and if I'm researching something for a blog or a book, I will schedule that reading as part of my workday. Also note that I travel a lot, and a sizable chunk of my reading happens on airplanes. Depending on the length of a trip, I can usually knock out anywhere from 2 to 5 books in a single trip. For those of you who want advice for reading more efficiently, there's an old members post here, How to Read Faster and Retain More. On to the top 10. Book number 1, The Fundamentals of the Metaphysics of Morals by Immanuel Kant. At the risk of sounding like a pretentious fucktard, this little 90-page classic from Kant possibly changed my life, and it was easily the most profound book I read this year. It all started when a friend and I, while riding the train to a concert, got in an argument about Sam Harris. I admire Harris, but his moral philosophy has never sat well with me. It seems logical and coherent on the surface, but it starts to fall apart upon further scrutiny. I mentioned to my friend that Kant's philosophy had always appealed to me, although I had never read about it. Kant's moral philosophy gets kind of shat on these days among intellectual podcasts and pundits. It's usually caricatured into some ridiculous example, like if getting into a car is not the correct thing to do in every situation, then it must be the incorrect thing to do in every situation. As such, my friend started teasing me about it, and I got a little pissed, both at my friend, but also at myself for not being able to actually defend something that appealed to me on an instinctual level. So I resolved that night to at least introduce myself to Kant's philosophy and read it for myself to determine whether it really was as ridiculous as all the podcasts and pundits made it sound. If there's one big lesson I've taken from it this year, it's that reading and understanding summaries of philosophy is no replacement for reading the philosophy itself, and the reading of the original Kant was the clearest example of this for me. Kant is no easy read, but in 90 short pages, his insight and clarity on ethics penetrated far deeper than any summary or argument I've heard about it in the last 10 years. Put simply, hearing a summary of Kant's ethical arguments is like reading a summary of a football game, rather than playing it yourself. That said, allow me to summarize, ha! Kant's moral philosophy as simply as I can, and why it matters so much to me. Kant basically says that any ethics based on emotion or pain and pleasure cannot be a rational morality, because emotion, pain, and pleasure are relative from individual to individual. Some people benefit from their pain, others suffer from their pleasure. What brings one person pleasure brings another pain, and vice versa. The only rational way to determine morality, Kant argues instead, is to remove individual context from it at all. To essentially find abstract principles that should apply in all situations to all individuals equally. Put another way, if it's immoral for me to lie to someone, it must be immoral for you or anyone else to do it too. You cannot have a behavior be moral in one context and immoral in another. So what does Kant suggest is the basis of morality? What is his categorical imperative? That is, the moral code that is universal and applies equally in all contexts. Well, I'll explain it as best I can, which, be assured, is not very well. All rational sentient beings must be treated as ends and of themselves and not means to other ends. I know, not very sexy, but let's unpack this. This basically means that the ultimate value in the universe is consciousness, and everything else must be secondary. It means that all actions and behaviors directed towards others must be unconditional, that is, made without expectation of something in return. Sound familiar? They must be made by putting consciousness itself as a highest priority. Everything else must be secondary. It also means all actions that we traditionally consider damaging, such as lying, cheating, stealing, are damaging because they treat other humans as a means to some other end, and not in and ends and of themselves. You lie to someone to gain an advantage over them, i.e. they are a means to your end. You kill someone to protect yourself. They are means to your end. You cheat at school to compensate for what you believe is an unfair advantage your classmates have over you. You treat them as means to your own end. Kant would unequivocally consider all of these behaviors wrong. Kant's morality is also radical in that it extends beyond humanity. He was one of the first, if not the first, to consider this. He argued that if we ever discover that some animals are capable of reason, that we must extend the same moral behavior towards them. He also argued that if we ever discover some other race of beings, like aliens, that are capable of rationality, this morality would extend to them as well. This is because, for Kant, the root of morality is not the soul or happiness or pleasure, but rationality. Rationality, to Kant, is sacred because it is, as far as he can tell, the only thing that is truly unique to the human condition. A mosquito feels pain and pleasure, yet we care little about it. An amoeba can grow and evolve and discover new ways of being. But it is rationality and the consciousness that arises as a result of rationality, that is its own special engine within the universe, capable of creating and inventing new meaning where there was none before. This must be cherished at all costs. This last idea blew my mind wide open. I had spent much of 2016 and early 2017 in a bit of an existential fog and mild depression. The success of Subtle Art did a real number on me, existentially speaking. A lot of my dreams were accomplished, and therefore destroyed. I felt aimless and constantly questioning what the hell I was supposed to do. Nothing I considered seemed to matter. Nothing seemed to make sense. Until I read Kant. My thinking has continued to evolve, and the next three books on this list are books that I read as a direct result of my perspectival shift that began with Kant. Together, they're adding up to a new worldview I haven't had before. They are also largely informing the subject matter of the next book that I would like to write. Book number two, Why Information Grows, by Cesar Hidalgo. I saw Why Information Grows referenced in Harari's Homo Deus, which is discussed below, as a good explanation of what Harari calls dataism, a new quasi-religion arising around big data and global connectivity. Hidalgo starts with a fascinating question. In a universe dictated by entropy, how does order arise and maintain itself, much less increase exponentially? One could look at life itself as merely the emergence of a self-directing order in a vast sea of inanimate random matter. So where does this order come from? To me, this book dovetailed perfectly with Kant's point about the sacredness of rationality. Hidalgo early on makes the point that Earth is the only place in the known universe where information both thrives and expands at rapid rates, that we are the equivalent of a black hole of order. A rare phenomenon where information approaches infinity and order expands seemingly endlessly. The second half of the book then looks at calculating information and processing power across the world and attempts to explain global economic dynamics based on the amount of information present in various societies. It's quite ambitious, and while it doesn't always hold up, it's one of the most fascinating books I've read in a long time. Book number 3, Gödel, Escher, and Bach, An Eternal Golden Braid, by Douglas Hofstadter. I'm going to be honest. I've tried to read Gödel, Escher, Bach at least 2 different times in the last 3 years and failed. Spoiler, there's a bunch of math and stuff. But this time I powered through and I'm extremely grateful I did. 2 comments here. 1, not even considering the content of the book, the format is absolutely a joy to go through. Hofstadter pulls from number theory, music theory, visual arts, molecular biology, Zen Buddhism, ancient philosophy, and funny little dialogues with talking animals, and somehow ties them all together neatly into an 800-page book about paradoxes, self-referential systems, AI, and consciousness. The amount of thought and effort that went into this book is dizzying, as well as breathtaking. It may be the most impressive book I've ever read in my life, for whatever that's worth. 2, the central point of the book takes a long time to get to. In fact, you spend almost 700 pages leading up to it. Hofstadter complains in the preface to the anniversary edition that most people who read GEB actually don't get to the main point, and part of that is likely because he doesn't get to it until the last chapter. His point is that systems, be they DNA strands or logic, formal logic systems or computer programming languages or the human brain itself, are all self-referential and inherently incomplete. This self-reference and incompleteness creates a sense of paradox, such as, the following sentence is false, the preceding sentence is true. He then argues that it's the emergence of these self-referential systems that make up the basis of consciousness, that essentially, what we understand as the self is merely a symbol constructed within the mind that is always interacting with every other symbol the mind constructs. In that sense, what we perceive as consciousness is a constantly fluid system of interactions between the mind's self symbol and its other symbols. I'm not doing his thesis justice, of course, but the other reason I love this book is that it tied in well with the 2 books above. It explains how matter can organize itself into such patterns of information that it can spin up and start processing greater and greater amounts of information to the point that it becomes conscious, and how this is a very special and rare thing indeed. Book number 4, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, by Elizabeth Colbert. One of the last books I read this year is also one of the most startling. I bought The Sixth Extinction because I wanted to learn more about the details and effects of climate change. That and the book won a Pulitzer Prize, so it should be good. What I got was actually a deeper insight into the history of understanding of life and our place as humans in that history. Throughout the history of Earth, there have been 5 mass extinctions. These mass extinctions have caused the death of anywhere from 50 to 90% of all species on the planet in a short amount of time. The most famous mass extinction is the asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs, and almost everything else. The book leans into the idea that humanity, when looked at on a geological timescale, is arguably the 6th mass extinction, the first time any single species has had the honor of causing such calamity. There's a lot more than climate change involved, too. Apparently, the global transport of species, bacteria and fungus, wreaks havoc on local habitats and ecosystems. The effects we're having on the ocean are likely just as disastrous, if not more, than the rising temperature or disappearing forests. But most importantly, the book gave me a greater appreciation for the diversity of life. I've always known there's a lot of plants and animals and shit out there, but it's always been this abstract concept of like, oh yeah, there's a lot of life and stuff. But the degree of biodiversity going on the planet is just as staggering, and therefore just as special, as the size of the universe or the complexity of the atom. I slept through most of my biology classes in school, so this was a nice slap in the face for why I should care about these sorts of things. I don't know if this book has changed my habits or behaviors yet, I just finished a few days ago, but it has gotten me seriously thinking, and when combined with the Kantian morality and seeing life not as some magical thing but rather an incredibly rare form of complexity that must be taken care of, I feel like I'm slowly building a new ethic for myself that will eventually trickle down into new lifestyle habits and behaviors. Overall, these four books, as well as, to a limited extent, Homo Deus below, have deeply altered my understanding of reality this year. And while there are individually powerful reads, it's the combination of ideas between them, the way they support and buttress each other, that has resulted in real questioning for me about my purpose and place in this world. The next four fit together as well, although the theme is different and a little more unsettling. Book number 5, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, by Steven Greenblatt. The Swerve started a bit slow and it was hard to see where it was going, but it turned out to be incredible. I won't spoil the specifics, but let's just say that a handful of highly educated transcribers in medieval Italy with a passion for ancient Roman philosophical texts are the only reason the Renaissance, and therefore arguably modernity, ever happened. The book focuses primarily on the hunt for the text On the Nature of Things by Lucretius, a Roman poet and philosopher who lived around 50 BC. The fact that this text survived 1,500 years is a marvel in and of itself, as the Catholic Church had banned it during the Roman Empire and burned all known copies of the text, or so they thought. What's in the text is just as spectacular as the fact that anyone found it. Let's just say that Lucretius called pretty much everything we take for granted as obvious and true today. Atoms, evolution, the earth being round, and so on. Way back in 50 BC. What was most shocking about Swerve, though, aside from how incredible the story is the realization of how intellectually and economically punishing the fall of the Roman Empire really was. I had always assumed that Christianity had more or less worked out as a net positive for humanity. Now I'm not so sure. They call it the Dark Ages for a reason. The leading thinkers and scholars of antiquity were almost entirely lost. The Western world became less educated and more violent. European civilization would require another 1,500 years to catch up where it was before. One lesson here is that history is not a straight line. Things don't always improve. In fact, they can easily fall apart and get worse. We take for granted that things will simply always get better because that's all we've known in the past few centuries. But Western civilization already took one detour that lasted 1.5 millennia, and there's nothing saying that it can't happen again. This last point is actually the big realization that holds this and the next three books together in my mind, and why they were so impactful for me this year. While I tend to be skeptical of people who think that things like Trump or North Korea are going to cause a civilizational collapse, after all, collapses happen over the course of centuries, not years, it has reoriented my understanding of the incredible progress the world has made the past few centuries, and how fragile that progress may be. Book number 6, Escape from Evil by Ernest Becker. That progress is fragile, Becker says, because humans naturally gravitate towards cultures built on tribal and supernatural beliefs. Becker is the author of one of my favorite books of all time, Denial of Death, which I also reread this year. Escape from Evil was a half-completed follow-up before he died of cancer. His wife gathered his notes and had it published shortly thereafter. Denial of Death was profound in that it argued all personal motivation, meaning, and purpose stems from the avoidance of the reality of our own death. We are terrified of our own mortality, and so we erect immortality projects to temporarily convince ourselves that our identity will last forever. This is the same concept I referenced in the last chapter of Subtle Art. Escape from Evil takes the same realization and applies it to cultures at large. Much of what we consider culture and religion are merely socially agreed upon practices that help us all escape the reality of our own meaningless lives. If it sounds bleak, it's because it fucking is. Becker argues that wars, mass violence, prejudice, and bigotry all become rational when you consider that people are literally fighting for their own psychological sense of immortality. Book number 7, The Retreat of Western Liberalism by Edward Luce. I saw The Retreat of Western Liberalism discussed on Vice's website this summer, and it sounded like another part of the Trump is the end of the world hysteria, which I generally try to not take part in. But then I saw it pop up a few more places and mentioned as a serious historical critique of liberalism and some of our assumptions about it. Luce essentially picks up where Becker left off with concrete historical examples. He demonstrates that democracy and Western liberal values, such as free speech, are non-existent in human history, and that while we often take for granted that all human progress will naturally follow the liberating progress of Western European culture, there's nothing guaranteeing that. For all we know, the past 200 to 300 years could have been an anomalous blip of human history, much in the same way that Greek and Roman democracy was. Luce points out that in the 21st century, we've seen an abandonment of the adoption of democratic values across the world, as well as seeing those values recede here at home. It's a deeply depressing yet important book. Number 8, Homo Deus, The History of Tomorrow, by Yuval Noah Harari. I thought Homo Deus was much weaker than Harari's previous book, Sapiens. I've heard that Sapiens took him almost 10 years to write, so the fact that Homo Deus showed up a mere 2 years later suggests that he either rushed through it or that it contains a lot of extra stuff that never made it into Sapiens. But I digress. There was one section in here that really made the whole book worthwhile. Harari's whole thing is that human society is constructed around myths, and not just religious myths, but money is a myth, government is a myth, corporations are a myth, legal systems are a myth. They're myths that we all believe in because they help organize larger groupings of society. This myth thing was the big mind blower in Sapiens. The mind blower in Homo Deus, for me, was not all the futurism stuff, which is what I think other people got excited about. None of the futurism stuff was new to me. What was new to me was his criticism of humanism. To Harari, humanism is just another myth, a form of secular religion based on the ideals of providing as much freedom and little suffering as possible to the most people possible. Harari points out that with all the amazing progress humanist values have granted the world, they also bring with them flaws and problems that the old religions never had. One is the existential anxiety that comes with believing that you're responsible for everything that happens in your life. Another is the overestimation of individualism, the idea that acting on our own behalf is always better. Another is the implicit belief that greater freedom equals greater happiness. Harari also points out that the most destructive wars in human history emerged through the conflict of different denominations of humanism: communism, capitalism, and fascism. The big takeaway here, as with all of these four books, is that A, the great Western philosophical success of the past 400 years is a brittle anomaly in the grand scheme of human civilization, and B, that we may actually end up being on the losing side of history here. It got me thinking about what the blind spots in our own humanistic religion may be, and what a more effective religion may look like. Book number 9, Some, by David Eagleman. My buddy Derek Sivers recommended this little book to me, saying it was one of his favorite books ever. There are 40 chapters, each of which is only 3 to 4 pages long. Each chapter is a different hypothetical situation when you die. There's the afterlife, that's one gigantic airport waiting room. There's the afterlife where you get to choose what you want to be reincarnated as. There's the afterlife where you discover that actually we're the AI invention of some inferior race. Every vignette punches you with either a fun or emotional lesson. Many of them get you thinking to the point that you need to put the book down for a few minutes. The creativity per page ratio in this thing is higher than almost any other book I've come across. It's a real joy to read. Book number 10, The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis. Perhaps the most readable nonfiction author since Malcolm Gladwell, Michael Lewis returned this year with The Undoing Project, a biography on the superheroes of psychological and behavioral economic research, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. These two guys are the brilliant minds that shook up all of psychology and economics and are behind a lot of the ideas that show up on this blog. As always, it was a real treat to let Lewis' storytelling magic take me through their careers and how they arrived at their conclusions. So I'm going to stop the audio there. I still have the list of all 66 books I read this year, and then there's also a list of the 14 books I started reading but stopped, with short explanations of why I stopped. If you're really interested, hop on the site, markmanson.net/favoritebooks2017, and let me know if you have any feedback or book recommendations or anything else you'd like to hear from me. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your 2018. Happy 2018. Happy festivities and all that stuff. So talk to you soon.